The United States has more libraries than the leading fast food chain has restaurants. Libraries are ubiquitous, highly used, and a great source of pride to American communities. We tend to think we know what libraries are about. But library scholarship is something less prominent on the public radar. It's a matter of how we think about libraries, their resources, and effects. And we'll talk to one of the best such thinkers around next on Media Meet. Hello and welcome to WNMU's Media Meet. I'm Bill Hart. Our guests are Professor Emeritus of Library Information and American Studies at Florida State University, Wayne Wiegand, Northern Michigan University Dean of Academic Information Services, Darlene Walsh, and Marquette's Peter White Public Library Director, Pam Christensen. Welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to have you all here. Dr. Wiegand, your education was primarily in history, with a master's in library science along the way. Had you always intended to do historic researches on libraries and related issues? How did this direction come about?
I kind of fell into it. When I was doing my doctorate in history, it became pretty obvious to me that the state of the economy wasn't going to present me with a lot of employment opportunities once I finished with my PhD. As many doctoral students in history back then, we did an additional field of inquiry and tried to harness that additional field of inquiry into an employment opportunity. I had always liked working in public and academic libraries, so I simply thought this is a great way to go. I will get myself a master's degree in librarianship, then practice for a couple of years, and then hope to find a career in a School of Library and Information Studies somewhere where I could teach library history and book history. And that's the way it turned out.
Okay. I don't think that's terribly unusual. I've known library science people who come from other backgrounds. And MLS is an advanced degree. How common is it and how encouraged is it?
These days, the master's degree in library information studies has always been considered the terminal degree for people who want to become professional librarians. Mm-hmm. That's still the case. What has happened, of course, is that the nature of the technologies that libraries harness in order to accomplish their work efficiently has been altered significantly by the computer and what all the ripple effects of that computer has. So things have opened up in other ways for people who come through accredited programs that don't necessarily point them in the direction of libraries, more pointing them in the direction of providing information and making it accessible for potential employers. So it's still the terminal degree for people who get into the practicing of the library profession, but there probably are fewer programs now than there were when I graduated or when my fellow library professionals here graduated. But they are still, it's still a terminal degree for practicing, yeah.
And it's, it actually is interdisciplinary. Care to speak to that, Darlene?
Several of the students that we've had working at Olson Library at Northern Michigan University have caught a spark on that, and they do go off to graduate school, which has been really nice. It is, as Dr. Wiegand said, is their entry into the profession, and they do go that route. Okay. So we've had that influence, which has been kind of nice, actually.
Okay. Has that gotten to the public libraries around the country that you know of, Pam?
Well, I think it depends on each library's philosophy and how they want to build their staff. When I came to Peter White 20 years ago, we had 2.5 MLS employees. Now we're at 5.5, just because we really placed the emphasis on trying to have department heads that had a degree. But I think that there are fewer jobs open now. It used to be if you looked at journals or online listings, there'd just be pages and pages of jobs. And it just doesn't seem to me like there are as many now as there were probably 20 or 30 years ago.
Okay. Dr. Wiegand, in 1992 at the University of Wisconsin, you served as founder and co-director of the Center for History of Print Culture and Modern America, a joint program with the Wisconsin Historical Society. Can you tell us about the center, its mission, and its relevance to your inquiries.
Right. Well, I did move from University of Wisconsin-Madison to Florida State in 2002, so I abandoned the directorship of that program at that time, but I'm still well-connected to it and well-versed in what it does. Like most, when we come into contact with a new technology, we begin to think about how did the old technology evolve? What influence has it had? Just prior to this, I was part of a group of scholars, library historians and book historians, invited by the Rand Corporation to Los Angeles to try to figure out what happened after the invention of movable type in the middle of the 15th century and how that impacted on societies at that time. Because what the Rand Corporation was trying to figure out was which direction is are these new technologies going to take us in terms of information access and retrieval and storage. And what we found at the Rand Corporation from this group of people was that individual groups took this invention, movable type, and they used it in many different ways. And the Rand Corporation could not come up with a homogeneous a solution to those questions. I took this back with me to the Wisconsin-Madison campus and thought, you know, we ought to ask those kinds of questions on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. And so we organized this particular program. Our idea was particularly aimed at the printed materials of groups residing on the margins of dominant cultures, because those were the strength of the Wisconsin Historical Society collections. Now, of course, we had vested interest there. We wanted those collections studied, but we also had altruistic interests there, and that was Native Americans and African Americans and women and other marginalized groups had a rich history in the culture of print that had been underanalyzed against white male dominant groups. So that really was a combination of our agenda items there. One was altruistic, one was not so altruistic.
Okay. Are collections like this growing, do you think?
Boy, I'm not sure. I don't know, Pam.
Not really in the public library field, I don't think, because we've always... Well, most public libraries try to be popular materials centers. Your academic institutions, I think a lot of them do specialize in either local or regional things because, well, you know it's going to get preserved and studied sure. if that happens. But most of us in the public library field, you know, other than local history and maybe genealogy, don't specialize much in special collections.
They'll probably find their way to archival collections. Mm-hmm.
Here the archivist is going to be assuming the responsibility for gathering those things, and often I think they are those pieces around the edge that contribute to the community and trying to preserve what's going on in those specialized groups and populations. And our archive certainly does that.
I'm curious about influences here. There are viewpoints and techniques of historiography that tend to stand the past on its head and change our way of looking at them. We've had revisionist historians, intellectual historians. Some apply theories, arcane theories like Marx and Freud. And there are European scholars who take a philosophical position. Did any of this rub off in your work? Was this stuff that was interesting?
I'm bathing in it. most professional programs like journalism and librarianship, there's usually a historian on the faculty of the professional program faculty. And the historian's job is to sort of locate the evolution of that particular information agency or institution in a broader context. So in some places you get individuals who explore this very broadly, and in some places you get this individual who explores it rather narrowly. Now, Michel Foucault uses this term discourse, and I often use that term in my own writing. Librarianship has a particular professional discourse, and often I think of it as the box in which we work, and that box has a great deal of influence over what we see as the universe of possibilities. So if what I do has value to the profession of librarianship, I'm better off shopping outside the box if I can. Right. So I'm looking at theoreticians and theoretical frames that question that particular box, or that try to expand it a bit, open it up so that there are more questions introduced into the box, and thus can make perhaps give better guides to future planning. I think if I have value, what my research has value to the profession of librarianship, it is questioning the existing discursive formations, to be Foucauldian on you, and getting librarians to think outside that box about possibilities that might open up to them. I always told my students, there's no place in the Bible, the Quran, the Talmud, or the Book of Mormon, where it says a library must be this. There's no place like that. We make libraries what they are. And if we see possibilities for libraries beyond the discourse we currently have, we ought to consider that as part of the future. You mentioned more libraries than fast food restaurants.
Sure.
One of the unique things, and some might view this as a weakness. I don't. I view it as a strength. One of the unique things about particularly public libraries is that they are voluntary institutions. People do not have to use them.
Yeah.
Because they do not have to use them, they exercise power and influence over the public library. This happens in academic libraries to some extent because the faculty has a great deal of influence over whether students use the academic library or not. And it happens in school libraries because the curriculum that state departments of education determine students ought to have, that also influences that. But the public library in particular, it's a voluntary institution. Now, I take the perspective, and this has been in the last 20 years, the discourse can be characterized in the phrase the library, the user in the life of the library. When Pam inherited the Peter White Library, along with it came a whole bunch of thinking that looked primarily at the user in the life of the library. I like to turn that on its head. I like to think of the library in the life of the user because that allows me to see what kind of power and influence the users have had on the evolution of this institution over the course of the decades.
Sure, that's great. So you're doing for libraries what Foucault did with medicine and madness and a number, I could say the clinic, you know, in terms of medicine and stuff like that. And in some cases, scholarship itself.
You're very kind to say that. I'm trying to do that. People in the library profession read what I write or not. If someone is asking you to think outside the box and you're very comfortable inside that box and you're being rewarded based upon your ability to replicate past patterns, there's not that much cause for you to think otherwise. So to some extent, you're right, but then again, it's pretty easy. You know, when you write a book, there are three things that can happen. You can get it reviewed best, you can get it reviewed worst, or you can get ignored. And you want at least to be reviewed best or worst. You don't want to be ignored.
Okay. Just a reminder here for our viewing audience and especially our radio audience that we're talking about library scholarship with Professor Emeritus of Library Information and American Studies at Florida State University, Wayne Wiegand. Northern Michigan University Dean of Academic Information Services, Darlene Walsh, and Peter White Public Library Director, Pam Christensen. The one of the terms you use frequently is print culture. I mean, everything has a history. You've sort of defined that as a region of study. What are we being directed toward there?
Right. I'll just turn that around on you a little bit and call it the culture of print. And that encompasses much more than just the printed text. That also encompasses the associational behaviors that occur when one interacts with printed text. For example, I walked through the Linda Olson Library a couple of hours ago, and there are students stretched out on the couch in the soft chairs reading books. This is part of the act of reading. People find their comfortable places in order to engage text. At the same time, Darlene's got rooms set aside where students can gather, and they may be discussing one text in common. They may have several texts in there on the same subject. All of that constitutes a culture in which print is sort of at the center of it. So when I say the culture of print, it's associational behaviors that print embodies. Every Sunday morning, my wife and I will sit on our porch in Florida and read the New York Times. And we're tossing things back and forth to each other consistently. Sometimes that will invite the other person to read the article. Sometimes you think, well, I've got enough of that message and I'm not going to read the article. So there is a social nature to the act of reading that is evident when you think of the culture of print, not just print.
Okay, very interesting. Let's look at a couple of publications. It's a couple of publications. It seems to begin with History of a Hoax. Could you tell us about that and what you hope to convey by it? This was in story, wasn't it? Something among librarians.
Couple of librarians in the early 20th century decided to spoof the library profession, and they found this manuscript that they said was an old librarian's almanac. Which gave directions on how to conduct, and of course they addressed issues like bed bugs in the pages and snakes eating on the pages, et cetera. And they marketed this as if it were a real old librarian's almanac, and most of the major media that took it up and reviewed it as if it was a real old librarian's almanac. Well, then the story came out that it was a spoof, and I got to look at the manuscript collection of one of the hoax masters to it, and it was just a cute little story that I thought would be a good first venture into the publishing world, and it worked, so I was happy with it. Yeah. But I certainly do recommend the Old Librarian's Almanac to your library practice, if only for a joke a day. How's that?
Like we might recommend the Devil's Dictionary. Yeah. Before exploring this more, there's a sentiment among many people who examine public affairs that we've kind of lost our objectivity. And this might have relevance to one of the topics you've written on. Sometimes it's traced to settled beliefs and opinions that are hard to shake. I understand there's a common viewpoint regarding public libraries as guardians of democracy, foes of censorship, that sort of thing, that could be challenged. In fact, it seems you have challenged it here and there. What can you tell us about library faith?
Yes. The library faith sort of came out of the late 19th century when people were convinced that providing good books would affect good social behavior, whereas providing bad books would have the opposite effect. Now, people who entered the library profession with that conviction could be argued to hold the library faith. And I think there's a line that goes from the late 19th century to contemporary library practice, which holds that true. You can see from community to community. I don't know in particular about Marquette, but the libraries help to determine a cultural center that's acceptable to the majority of people in the community. I think that's one of their strongest contributions to their local communities, is providing a platform where those debates can take place and solutions are effected. So I always have argued in the last decade or so, that if you allow libraries to do their best work, mediate these disputes, sometimes they're visible, sometimes they're not visible, what will evolve is social harmony. People can accept this as a possibility. If you go the other way, however, you're putting Pam in the position of having to defend Hustler magazine if she chooses to acquire it. Pam, do you get Hustler magazine?
We don't, no.
Yeah, okay, and that wouldn't be, I don't know of a public library that does. Or other extremities in the culture of print, like National Enquirer. Do you get National Enquirer? So you see in Pam's collection development a mediation process taking place. Yeah. It would not be in her best interest. It would not be in the Peter White Library's best interest to collect Hustler magazine, because people in the community would rise up and protest against that. For her, however, to subscribe figuratively and literally to the Library Bill of Rights, one could argue she's violating several of the principles by not providing it, because I'm guessing somewhere here in the community of Marquette, someone can go to a bookstore or a truck stop and pick up that magazine if they want. So it is available.
Do you feel, either of you feel pressured to be an arbiter of taste or, you know, some special value when you're evaluating your collections and making recommendations to people?
We do, but part of it has to do with a focus in the academic library to support a curriculum. And I think it's changed over time. We never could afford to get everything that was out there.
Yeah.
I think it's changed over time where it's now actually almost easier to cope with, because it's easier to get access to a lot of things that we might not have acquired otherwise.
Okay.
I was laughing when you said about the National Enquirer, because in an instruction program, we have actually brought that in. We didn't bring Hustler in, but we did bring in the National
yeah.
Enquirer. And part of that is to help students understand the nature of what they're finding, which is a challenge. So as part of the collection, we do, rightly or wrongly, yeah. positively or negatively, steer it, both because of budgets, because of mm-hmm. collection focus, et cetera. But we also try to help people realize that there is a whole lot of other stuff out there, and they have to grapple with what they're finding and how they want to use it.
I could see it useful in some critique of journalism or mm-hmm. yeah. learning to critique journalism. How about you?
Well, I think there is so much available now, and what we try to do is focus on what gets reviewed in professional literature and select that. I mean, there are things in our collection that I've read, and I didn't really appreciate them, and I don't think the majority of people do, but I still think it's important for us to have those items in the collection. And I think it's important for everyone to make their own decision and for parents to help children make decisions about what they're going to read. I think our staff, our professional staff, does a very good job. I think we have a much broader collection than a lot of public libraries do. I also think that Marquette is a very different community. You know, people say to me all the time, well, what's going to happen with books?
Sure.
And Marquette is a very literate community and very tied to books. I think in other locations, you see a much bigger drop in the people using books. Yes, we have downloadable audio and downloadable ebooks, but for many of the people in our community, they're still very tied to books themselves, the object. And so I think we are probably more diverse than a lot of public libraries just because of where we are. But I mean, there's always the joke where people will ask for something and, you know, the staff says, well, no, we don't have that. No one ever, you know, no one ever checks it out. Well, no, because you don't have it. I mean,
sure.
there's that age-old question, and there's always been that with public libraries and even academic libraries.
Okay. There is some evidence for libraries being an instrument for propaganda. I understand it. In your book, The American Public Library During World War I, did patriotic zeal there get the best of our judgment, you think?
How did? I think so. To some extent, when you individuals
if this was resurrected in the 50s too with the Red
yes,
Scare.
Yes.
Yeah.
Individuals tend to interpret history from the point at which they become conscious of themselves. So normally, when Darlene and Pat think about what was history, as they're thinking in terms of their own lifetime. I don't think that way because I'm a trained historian. I think much broader contexts. So it was a surprise to the library profession when I resurrected the record of World War I, the public library's record in World War I, and what I discovered, among many other things, first and foremost, that was when the library really took its place as an important cultural, social, and literary institution in the panoply of civic institutions at the time. Everybody at the end of World War I recognized the library as a contributor. It did a whole lot for food conservation. It did a whole lot of assimilation programs for recent immigrants, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Did a lot of dissemination of government information that the government considered essential to citizens so that they could participate in the war effort. But the government also identified texts it did not find acceptable in training camp facilities. And librarians seized upon those lists. And in many cases, I can think of several here in the Midwest, librarians pulled that stuff off the shelf and they took it downstairs and they threw it in the furnace. Okay. So in that book, I cover issues of censorship, and librarians really, because they think of, they like most other humans, tend to think of history in terms of their own lifetime, had lost track of that activity. And it's not something that gets repeated regularly in the post-World War I library press, so it's easy to lose track of that. Mm-hmm. So that's what I found. Now, this gets replicated to some extent in the 1950s, and I would say it's being replicated today in to some extent. When you had the Joseph McCarthy era.
Sure.
And McCarthy would send his minions around to USI, United States Information Agency libraries across the world, and identify texts that he considered questionable and then bring public profile. Many libraries took those lists into their collections, and they didn't necessarily throw them into the furnace, but they did pull them and put them on special shelves. We have a term that evolved from the late 19th century for special places where libraries put works they didn't want to get rid of, but mm-hmm. they were controversial. They called them the Inferno at that time. And I think the libraries still do have infernos because they're an essential mediating device between a librarian's desire to supply information but a community's desire to somehow have it controlled so it doesn't fall into the wrong hands.
So libraries are still susceptible to political and social pressures. Do you think any of that is ameliorated by the fact that we always have the internet to turn to?
I would, of
not
course.
Just a
yes, of
book
course.
And a shelf.
Yes.
Yeah.
That libraries, public libraries, I don't know about the academic libraries, have filtering systems on access to the internet. Is a manifestation of that mediating process that I think is a strength rather than a weakness. So, yes, we still do it. And it replicates the reviewing systems that we've evolved over the centuries, over the generations, to identify what that best reading is, the good books, if you will. So it's just continuing to do what we've done in the past.
We've been talking about libraries and library scholarship with Professor Emeritus of Library Information and American Studies at Florida State University, Wayne Wiegand, Northern Michigan University Dean of Academic Information Services, Darlene Walsh, and Marquette's Peter White Public Library Director, Pam Christensen. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Hart. Thanks for joining us on Media Meet.
The preceding program was produced in studios located in the Edgar L. Hardin Learning Resources Center by WNMU-TV, Northern Michigan University Public Television.